Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The world's changing, and what are things we can do to transform our business and engage our fans globally in different ways?
People are using their name and likeness to create more opportunities, more stakes in companies.
In order to turn the organization around, we had to turn it around not only just on the baseball operations side, but on the business operations side.
Football and any other sport is very difficult, but I like to broaden my horizons and be able to expand.
Sports need to be consumed live, and that's a big competitive advantage for intellectual property holders of sports content in the media landscape.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. I'm Scarlett Fu with Mike Lynch and Michael Barr, and a lot to talk about this week, especially since the NFL season is in full swing. Michael Barr, you've been watching very carefully because I know you have a few dollars on the line here when it comes to football. There was a big bet this weekend that would pay out a huge amount of money. Michael, it sounds really complicated. Walk us through what it involved and what happened.
Now, okay. For everybody out there, now if you don't know what a parlay is, this one was a 16-game parlay.
What does that mean?
In other words, you're trying to guess the winner of each of the 16 games that took place in week two.
Okay.
So you got through from the first game, then you go on through the Sunday games, and this bettor had 15 of them right. And then there's Monday Night Football, and the mighty Detroit Lions take on the Green Bay Packers in Lambeau Field.
There's Aaron Jones. Got it. Fourth touchdown of the night for Aaron Jones.
And see, the problem is the Lions don't have Aaron Jones. The Packers have Aaron Jones. And that was the fourth touchdown. And this bettor, who laid down $25 on a 16-team parlay, had the chance to win $737,000. But the Lions did not come through. And first of all, and I feel for you.
Wait, hold on. He put down $25 and he did not win $737,000,
right.
But he did get 15 of those bets in that parlay right.
Yeah.
So did he come out with anything?
No.
Nothing?
Nope.
Just like a lot of emotional highs and one big low.
Yep.
Nope. Nothing.
Yeah.
Not a doggone thing. And that's
kind of emotional torture.
It is. Well, that's the thing about parlays. It's you have to hit each one.
Yeah.
And now it depends on, you know, a lot of ways you can do a parlay. You can do it with the point spread, or you can just do it straight up. There are many ways you can do it. You don't have to do a 16-team parlay. You could do a 3-team parlay.
Okay, you can customize it.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. But I don't understand why you bet on the Lions in Lambeau Field, especially after
week one.
Well,
you would, Barr, right? You would.
No.
Nope.
I love my Lions dearly. But I'm not crazy. Well, okay, maybe after a couple of beers. But I'm not crazy. Yet the week one, Aaron Rodgers got benched. Now, you're talking a Hall of Fame quarterback. He got benched. So you knew that week two in Lambeau, they were going to come out with a vengeance, and they sure did. 35-17.
Is this where sports betting is a game of skill and not luck?
Go ahead,
Lynchy.
I'm still angry about the Lions losing.
It's more skill than playing the lottery, without question. Yeah, because you do a little homework. There's a lot of research and analytics going on, and it's easier to win betting sports than it is to win in Powerball or Megabucks.
You know, when you say there's a lot of homework, there are different businesses that supply the data, and of course, mm-hmm. everyone wants their names to be affiliated with that. Jimmy Pitaro, the president of ESPN, spoke with Emily Chang earlier this month. He was pretty tight-lipped in response to her question about whether ESPN would be licensing its name to a sports betting operator. But it's really interesting to see how far a company like Disney, which is the parent company of ESPN, has evolved on sports betting. I mean, Bob Iger, the CEO, back in the day, had earlier said in 2019 that he didn't see Disney getting involved in the business of gambling by facilitating gambling in any way, but partnering with companies that offered betting information was a different story. Do people make that distinction? I mean, between ESPN not being involved in gambling, but also offering betting information or having its name affiliated with that?
People go to the source that they trust the most. Who has given me good advice, good information that has translated into me winning a bet. There's also another part when you're betting on things, you want someone just to support what you're thinking. I think I like the Lions.
Validation.
What do you think? And you might call 10 people, they say, forget it. And then you call Michael Barr and he says, yeah, take the points. And you say, good, I feel good now. I'm going to lay in $50 on this game. But what this legalized gambling has done for viewership of NFL games, you're going to see going on and on and on. For like the first week, it was up 7%, I think, from a year ago. People are hanging around to the ends of the games because they can, in the middle of the game, they can bet, will I get a first down? Who will catch the next touchdown pass? Mm-hmm. I had a bunch of guys last week that were watching a meaningless game because if there were three of them, they would have won $900 if Michael Barr scored a touchdown in the last 2 minutes of the game.
Yeah, we know that didn't happen.
So the net effect is no game is ever meaningless. Every game is meaningful because of all the different bets that anyone could make. And you could do a 16-leg parlay. You could do, I don't know, 25-leg parlay. Could you do a 25-leg parlay, or you can't because there's only 16 games?
No, there's only 32 teams, 16 games. Okay. So Michael Barr will tell you, if you have bet even $10 on any game and you lost, and it happened 30 years ago, you can recite every single thing that went wrong that cost you that $10, you know, at the end of the game. Like one time I remember I had the over in a Monday Night Football game, and the team was on the 1 yard line. All they needed to do was get in the end zone and score 6 points, and I was in. They took a knee, and I'm screaming at the TV, screaming, get in the end zone, I'm gonna win $25. So you remember and you hang around and you watch.
And gentlemen, we're talking about the biggest stories in the world of sports right now. And one thing that's really caught my attention is all the attention given to Ken Burns' new documentary, Muhammad Ali. I have to confess that I never like watching boxing on television because it's just so brutally violent. But the stars of boxing really don't shine a light to the greatest, Muhammad Ali. And he called himself the greatest. I mean, that's how he identified himself, right?
I don't think that there's no heavyweight alive who couldn't beat me. I know there are none alive. And when I say greatest, I mean only boxing. See, in the Islamic religion, we have a saying, Allah o Akbar. Allah o Akbar means God is the greatest. So I'm not God. I'm just the greatest in the sport of boxing.
Ali, not modest there at all, but that's why people love him.
Yeah, Ali did boast. He was a little bit braggadocious about his talents. But you have to remember, during that time, too, is the time when he went from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, and there were a number of his political views and religious views. And at the time, a lot of people in the United States didn't take too kindly to it. Our good friend Jason Kelly sat down with Ken Burns, who's doing this documentary on Muhammad Ali, and he talked about some of the turbulence that went through for Muhammad Ali during that time.
Comes out of the Rome Olympics with a gold medal. He's smiling. He's voluble. He knows how to talk to a camera and a microphone, and people love him. And then he starts bragging, and he starts saying how beautiful he is. And he does the things that athletes are sort of not supposed to do, and particularly black athletes are not supposed to do. And so there's a kind of step up, and people talk about before the first listening fight, let's shut him up, let's put him in his place. And you can hear the echoes of what that's about. And then he joins, after he defeats List, and he publicly joins the Nation of Islam, a separatist religious cult. You can't even call it a branch of Islam. It's got its own problems, which we detail. And then it's already been labeled by mainstream media as a hate group. And there are aspects of it that are corrupt and hate-filled, and they are also the murderers of Malcolm X, one of their own, whom they expelled. And then, you know, he refuses the draft. And that puts him at odds with a majority of American citizens, black as well as white, who are essentially supporting the war, at least initially, and he won't budge. He knows he could get a cushy job. He knows he'd be doing USO shows and making appearances and mugging with GIs. He's not going to do that. And it is stunning, and it brings out the worst, and it brings out the best. He becomes a hero on college campuses, a hero to a different new kind of black manhood, black masculinity that maybe a generation before Jackie Robinson embodied. Now he embodies, Jim Brown embodies. It's a wonderfully complicated story, and then he works his way back. You know, he's exonerated by the Supreme Court. He loses to Joe Frazier, but in the words of the sports writer Robert Lipsyk, he wins America because he's trying desperately to get back in the game, which he knows he's losing on points, and he gets floored by Frazier in the last round, gets up, is willing to fight. He takes his defeat in a manly way, even though the lead up to the fight is he's just irresponsible in his treatment of Joe Frazier, calling him things that only a white racist would call another black man. And this is one black man to another. He's made Joe Frazier the hero of white America, and he's the hero, he believes, of black America. It's not his finest moment, but he's amazing at the end, and people by this time are beginning to realize, you know, he may have been right on Vietnam.
Right.
And then he works his way, and when he wins back the championship for the first time, it's one of the most magnificent moments in the history of sports of all time. You cannot believe that this underdog did what he did.
That was Ken Burns sitting down with our Jason Kelly. You can catch the entire interview right on our Bloomberg podcast page.
You know what strikes me is how ahead of his time Muhammad Ali was, because he was talking about these social justice issues that didn't win him a lot of fans in some parts of the market and some parts of the world. But it was almost like he knew he was doing it for posterity.
Yeah, he was a great marketer. Can you imagine? He was a self-promoter. If he could do that today, God rest his soul.
Names, image, and likeness?
Yes.
With Muhammad Ali?
Oh, my goodness. It's like, I remember it was a big deal when he was selling Decon roach traps. You remember that? It was whatever it was. And now he would be a multimillionaire 20 times over.
Well, one thing about a Ken Burns documentary, it breathes. And it goes in depth. And this documentary, I've watched 3 of the 4 episodes so far, takes him from the day he was born in Grand Avenue in Louisville, Kentucky. And then he loved boxing. He did graduate from high school. Some teachers didn't think he should be awarded a degree. His principal says, I believe in this guy. He's going to be a success. And so I'm going to award him his degree. And then he went on, as you said, he was a great marketer, Michael Barr. When he was fighting amateur fights and then became a professional, he would go door to door, knock on black doors of black people and white people, come on down to the Louisville Boxing Center on Saturday night, watch me fight. The more people that showed up, the bigger payday for Cassius Marcellus Clay. That was his born name. Went to the Olympics, won a gold medal in 1960, then beat Sonny Liston in 1964, and all of a sudden he went from Cassius Clay, a guy who yapped an awful lot, to one of the most popular and polarizing people on the face of the earth. But he used his popularity to fight bigotry, racism, unfairness, and injustice, everything that he had seen and experienced while he was growing up. There was a shot in this documentary about a carnival in town, and it was only for white people and white kids. And there's a shot of all the black little boys and girls clinging onto the chain link fence, looking from the outside in as all the white children are inside on the Ferris wheel and all the amusements in the carnival in town. And, you know, it really struck a chord, and it really defined the fabric of Muhammad Ali, who he was and why he, till the day he took his last breath, fought for fairness and fought against injustice.
Yeah, he became this global symbol of all these different conflicts, and he became bigger than himself. Again, I go back to the idea that I am by nature not a fan of watching boxing. It's too violent. It's too, it's crushing, the physicality involved. But you see someone like Muhammad Ali and what he was trying to do, what he was trying to communicate, and it quickly becomes much bigger than boxing.
Well, yeah, and the thing about boxing is that you have to remember way back from the 40s and the 50s, the Gillette Cavalcade of sports, and you would see the boxing match every Friday night, and then go on to the 60s, obviously with Muhammad Ali. The 70s, you would still could see a live boxing match on network TV. Yep. Back then, you know, if you wanted to see it, they used to call it closed circuit. So then became the 80s and pay-per-view. And,
right.
And then that's when I always wonder
event
if that's
television.
The point. Yeah, I just wonder if that's the point when boxing lost that allure, because you had to pay to see this event, and it's not necessarily cheap.
It became a niche event, a niche sport, and not a mass market sport.
Well, he was on live television on Wide World of Sports almost every Saturday with Howard Cosell, and he would just build up every one of his fights. And you could, I only paid to see one of his fights, the Larry Holmes fight, late in his career. But many of them were on live television on a Saturday afternoon, and you could just watch him fight Ken Norton on Wide World of Sports Saturday afternoon at 4:30. And he was just, you know, one of these most iconic figures of the in fact, Sports Illustrated named him as the athlete of the century, and many other publications and associations did the same thing.
We have a great set of guests with us today. We're going to talk about Saving the Roar. It's a documentary about Penn State, and I'm thrilled to have the director of this documentary with us, Mike Nash, as well as a former linebacker who's featured in this documentary, Michael Mowdy. Great to have you guys on. So glad you could join us. And Mike Nash, let me start with you, because this is a film about the fallout from the Jerry Sandusky child abuse scandal. It's about the 2012 Penn State football team that confronted all these challenges and the obstacles and overcame them. Tell us a little bit about how you came to this story and why you decided to make this documentary.
Yeah, hi. First of all, thank you for having myself and Michael Mowdy on. You know, this film came to me from a Penn State alumni, Bob Evans, who sits on the board of Penn State. And, you know, we had been talking about the film Paterno that HBO came out with, and he said, you know, there's another side to this story, which I had never heard before. And he illuminated, you know, really what these players went through in 2012. And that was really the beginning of you know, us starting to map this story out and outline it and try to figure out, you know, what was the best story to tell on this subject.
Mike, come on. You know, four mics here, you know that. Come on, that line had to go. You know that. Anyway, I have to ask this question, and there's so many ways to go with this documentary, and I'll start with Mr. Nash. When you talk about college football, you're talking about six or seven home football games. And the town's small businesses, they really count on those. Can you expand more on that and what that means for the local businesses and the local money that goes into it?
Yeah, I'm happy to. You know, this film, basically, I mean, the core of this film takes place in the summer of 2012 and then the season. And it was shortly after the NCAA put these almost, you know, death penalty-like sanctions on the university and the football program that really began to cripple not only the program, but the economic impact of the town. And so I don't know if any of you have ever been to Penn State, but it's not easy to get there. It's in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
So that community survives on those six or seven games. And, you know, if this team fell apart, and Michael Mowdy can get into this, but, you know, there was an afternoon where Michael Mowdy and Michael Zordage went to, just to add another Michael into the conversation.
We're up to five so far, everyone.
Zordage, yeah. You know, went to Coach Fitz and Coach O'Brien and, you know, showed him a list where there were 30 or, you know, up to 30, 40 players that were leaving possibly that afternoon. If that happens, that program can no longer recruit. They probably can't even field a team at that point. And if those six or seven games don't take place, you know, I mean, if you look at the numbers, we're somewhere around 5,000 jobs in state college, you know, take place because of local tourism. Those jobs are at stake if this, you know, team doesn't move forward. The football program, you know, brings in, I think roughly it's just under $800 million in tourist money that comes into that community. So there was a lot at stake besides just the football program. And in the film, you know, Frank O'Hara states that these young kids, we owe them everything because they not only had the past of Penn State on their shoulders, they also had the future of Penn State on their shoulders. And that proved to be very true.
Let's hear from one of the Michaels. Michael Zordich, he is or was at Penn State U defensive back. And here's what he said before the start of the 2012 season. Let's take a listen.
As a team, we don't see this as a punishment. This is an opportunity. This is the greatest opportunity a Penn Stater could ever be given. We have an obligation to Penn State, and we have the ability to fight for not just a team, not just a program, but an entire university and every man that wore the blue and white on that gridiron before us. We're going to embrace this opportunity, and we're going to make something very special happen in 2012.
So, Michael, you know, you're on the team. It was every single day. There were satellite trucks, TV cameras all over the place. You're probably getting ready to play Purdue or Ohio State or somebody. At any point during all this turmoil, did you say, I'm out of here. This isn't worth it. What am I doing here? What was going through your head?
I think that thought was definitely, for a quick moment, was there. I think it was very quickly, though. You know, me being a fifth-year senior, my dad had played there at Penn State. Michael Zordich, another captain, was my roommate at the time. His dad played at Penn State. You know, we just very quickly snapped out of that thought process and realized, you know, this isn't right, and we wanted to make sure that, you know, that we could hold this thing together. Now, at that point, I had had 60 offers, you know, literally the day after the NCAA sanction. Where any player could leave at any point. And I think a lot of people don't realize the gravity of having that ruling was in place the whole year. So you can imagine the difficulty in fielding and retaining a team throughout that year where, you know, we had jets at the airport waiting for us from every different school. But I think it just kind of shows you the kind of kids that are at Penn State and we just, you know, weren't going to sit by and let that culture, that community, really the community is when they rallied behind us and realized this just became much bigger than football.
So your coach at the time was, I know him quite well, Bill O'Brien. He came from the Patriots down there. Was he the right guy at the right time for that situation?
You know what? I'm not sure that he gets enough credit, and he probably wouldn't take it if you try to give it to him. But we certainly couldn't have gone through that without him. He seemed to make every right decision from a strategic crisis management standpoint. You know, we were in the war room every night, literally like 11 o'clock, strategizing on, you know, how we were going to re-recruit our team and what we were going to do. I mean, there was conversations about, you know, literally from the drawing board. We were going to have 20 guys, you know, discussing seceding from the Big Ten, and we were going to do this on our own, you know, we were going to cut our own TV deal. It was just, you know, it was literally crisis management 101. I don't think Bill deserves enough credit for the way he's handled it. I think he was, you know, perfect for that situation.
Mike Nash, let me turn to you first because you grew up a college football fan. You didn't go to Penn State, but you learned a lot about Penn State and the economics of college football. And I'm wondering what the most surprising part of that was.
Well, I think when you really look at the story and you realize that how close this program came in the summer of 2012 to ending, truly, you know, we call it the 6 weeks of chaos in the movie, but this program was truly upon its darkest hour. And if it wasn't for a group of, you know, millennials who came together and did not leave the university, I think the economic impact of State College, Happy Valley, I don't think Happy Valley would have been very happy. You know, these six or seven home games are so vital to the economics and the economic impact of that community.
obviously, what happened with the Jerry Sandusky controversy, I mean, that just all hell broke loose. But one of the people that got kind of caught up in this is head coach Joe Paterno. You're talking about a guy who had a stellar career. He had a stellar reputation, and all of it within those 6 weeks blows up.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it starts really in the mid-year 2011. I remember, you know, we were sitting in our dorm rooms, and when we got the message, it was a Wednesday. We were about to play Nebraska on a Saturday, and they, and then that meeting where Coach Paterno addressed the team for the last time. That's something I'll never forget. But myself being the legacy, the second generation product of Coach Paterno's, really the culture and the ethos that he always preached, and just hundreds of guys that have gone through that program and the impact that he's had on the whole community and that university. You can't say enough about that. And the way the university handled it, obviously, is there's certainly feelings that could have been handled better. But that's when the year before, in the 2011, was when that turmoil really just got started.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Mike Mauti, when the season ended and you guys were all together, was there a feeling of like, we did it? You know, we put the finger in the dike. We stopped the dam from just overrunning and Penn State football is going to survive? Or were you still unsure when the season ended?
Well, I mean, in 2011, you got to consider that we hadn't brought in Bill O'Brien yet. In February, I spoke at Coach Paterno's eulogy of standing next to Phil Knight. You know, the whole community is kind of still reeling. But then we got through to the summer of 12, and we had basically, like Michael was saying, Nash, 6 weeks of turmoil. I mean, we had 3 weeks where we just nonstop were trying to make sure we could field a team. And that's when we really, came to recognize that the community depended on this, us to play. And we had to play on TV, most importantly. And that's one thing Coach O'Brien always preached was, in hindsight, I realized how important that was, for us to play football and to play it on TV. And you're talking about 175 million annually into that community for 7 home weekends. And without football, we didn't realize at the time we were just 21-year-old kids. I think that's when it became clear that football was really, the vehicle to impact a lot of people.
Yeah, you're playing for the school, you're playing for the town, you're playing for the state of Pennsylvania in many ways. I want to play a clip from New York Giants running back Saquon Barkley talking about the significance of what this 2012 team managed to do when it did gather and decide to power through.
The 2012 guys are sitting here. The first thing I would say is thank you, because now understanding the Penn State history and the tradition, how strong and rich it is, and just to think from one mistake, all that could have been ruined. And those guys, stuck through it, and those guys were there when the program's at its lowest. And, in my opinion, just having the number up there, the year up there on the stadium is not enough.
Stuck through it at the lowest point. Mauti, you were drafted by the Vikings. You played for them for 2 years. You then moved to the Saints, and you played 35 games for the Saints through 2017. How often did this idea that you and this core group of players endured through that 2012 season for Penn State, is it something that you drew back upon in your professional career?
Certainly. I don't think that could go through anything in the future that could replicate that level of intensity and that level of meaning behind what you're doing in a season. And that bond that you create in a locker room where this is all you got, it's just the guy next to you and the coach is next to you, and you know, it's just a true display of what loyalty really can mean and commitment. And I think that was 10 years ago almost, you had basically the environment that you have now where anybody could leave and you know, the door's open. And so, yeah, I think it was just a truly special group. Nothing really could ever replicate the importance and the significance of playing for that much just by putting on the helmet. That's for sure.
Let's fast forward now. You're back in the days when you were 21, and now let's fast forward to about 10 years later. And you think about today with name, image, and likeness profits. Can you imagine, Mouty, sir, what your life would be like? I mean, you probably would own 7 car dealerships by now.
Well, there certainly were a lot of 42 jerseys sold then. it's a different world now. And I think a lot of, a lot of programs are definitely taking a reactive approach and don't really have a plan because this is the Wild West now. And I've seen it, and I've been working with, I've certainly had a lot of conversations within the, at Penn State in particular, but friends with different programs across the country. And I mean, it's a new arms race, basically, to engage the most capital in way of endorsements and paying players to recruit and retain them, more so than it has been ever. So I think it's a totally new climate, and it's certainly something to pay attention to, talking about 17, 18-year-old kids trying to manage and deal with a lot of characters coming around with a lot of money. And, I think it's important that they have good people around them to help them navigate.
Hey, Mike Nash, Mike Lynch up in Boston again. What's the takeaway that you want people to have? What do you want us to take away from this documentary? What's the common thread that runs throughout the whole piece?
Thanks, Mike. I mean, I think at the core of this film, it's really about overcoming adversity. It's about legacy bloodlines, childhood dreams, and there's great lessons within this film and within what Mouty and his team did back in 2012. That I think are great lessons for, everybody that's dealing with things that we're dealing with, in our own lives with COVID. And, we have certainly gone through our own adversity recently and, adversity that we didn't create, very similar to that team in 2012. They had nothing to do with this. When all of this took place with Sandusky, these kids were 4 years old, mm-hmm. That were now playing football for Penn State. I think there's also a really wonderful lesson, not only for society, but for businesses as well. And Mouty can probably speak on this more eloquently than myself, but, there's great value in the power of coming together as a team. And, we live in a world where it's all about, there's me-ism and we're all focused on selfies and this and that. But, man, when we can come together as a team, it's unbelievable the wonderful things that, are inspired and created throughout that movement. So I think at the core of it, that's really what this film is all about. This film is about a group of millennials doing things that, millennials traditionally aren't supposed to do. And if you like sports movies, if you like inspirational content, if you liked Rudy or We Are Marshall, this film fits within that same realm.
Mike Nash, I got to ask you about the funding for this documentary. Penn State has a loyal alumni base. Mouty can speak to that, of course. I wonder whether you had alums lining up to chip in or to be part of this experience of chronicling this 2012 team. And if not, whether they're coming out of the woodwork now.
You know, we actually were told that this would be financed within a couple of weeks from everybody that we spoke to. And that just was not the case.
Interesting.
We actually had a very difficult time finding funds for this. You know, I mentioned Bob Morgan earlier. He was key to all of this. But as the film started to get made and people could actually look at the type of film that we are talking about, look, the name of my company is Beverly Hills Productions. You know, I was living in Los Angeles at the time. The last time, you know, someone from LA made a movie about Penn State wasn't really happy about it. So, you know, we were walking on ice a little bit when we first started out until they realized the story that we were going to tell. And I think Maudy can attest to this too. When I first sat down and spoke with Michael had some other production companies that he'd been talking to. And when he asked me, he said, you know, how are you going to tell this story? I said, well, I'm not going to tell the story. You guys are going to tell the story. You know, there's not going to be any voiceover within this story. It's going to be told through the players and the coaches who were there, who lived this. And I think we lived, you know, up to that statement. But as people from, to answer your question more directly, as people started to see this, you know, this is really catching fire now within the Penn State community and the college football community. We had the world premiere of the film on Friday night. Kirk Herbstreit, you know, was there for game day. He introduced the movie. After the movie finished, and he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to stay because there was a little bit of a timeline, but after the movie finished, Michael and I were sitting in front of him. You know, he had tears in his eyes. This film took him on a journey, probably as a player and as a father who has, you know, a child playing in the NFL. So this is a very moving story for Kirk Herbstreit. I should also just share with you that anybody that is looking to view this film, it's on, you can go to savingtheroar.in.live, and that's in.live. We have what is known as a kind of COVID-safe home online theatrical release that's going to be going on for the next 30 days, 6 screenings a day.
Thank you for that. That's really helpful information for anyone who does want to see it. Really appreciate your joining us today. Mike Nash is the director and producer of Saving the Roar, which chronicles the 2012 Penn State football team, which powered through and put together a season in spite of the fallout from the Jerry Sandusky child abuse scandal. And also joining us is Michael Bowdy, former linebacker for Penn State and also for the Minnesota Vikings and New Orleans Saints in the NFL. That was a really interesting conversation we had with Mike Nash and Michael Mowdy. Mike Nash, of course, the director and producer of Saving the Roar, and Michael Mowdy, the former Penn State and NFL linebacker. What did you guys think in terms of how it matches up with your conception of the fallout on Penn State, the school, and the football program?
Well, I remember covering that, and just like Lindsay. And I remember when that all jumped off. And this is where I go back to the Joe Paterno days and how adored Joe Pa was. When all this went off, they literally, the students were, I don't want to call it a riot, but it was, let's say unrest. And there were news trucks trying to get the heck out of there. It got pretty scary for a second because the students were supporting Joe Pa.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about a guy who it was an institution. So that was a really tough time.
You know, I remember it very well because Bill O'Brien was the perfect coach at the right time. And Bill grew up pretty close to me here. He went to St. John's Prep, a Catholic high school. He went to Brown University, and he was Bill Belichick's offensive coordinator. And he said, I'm going to take the job down there. And we all said, are you nuts? I says, you know, you can't win down there. I said, they're going to take away scholarships. They've already forfeited bowl appearances. And there's going to be like a gaggle of photographers just running after you every single day, asking question after question after question that you have no answers for. And he said, I think I'm the right guy to get out and help fix this. And as you heard from Mike Mauder, he was. They lost their first two games. They won 8 of their last 10. They finished 6-2 in the Big Ten and 8-4 overall. But more importantly, he just calmed the storm. He just turned the temperature down on the anger and the resentment. And finally, as you know, Mike Nash told us in the interview, when this happened, the players on that team were 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and Bill O'Brien is up here. And Bill O'Brien has a severely, severely ill child with cerebral palsy who takes up an awful lot of his time. And he went down there and you know, basically was the sacrificial lamb, for a better phrase, down there. And he took it and eventually left for the Houston Texans. But that was my takeaway, and how much they were looking for leadership, as you can tell. Young kids are always looking for leadership, and Bill O'Brien was the right guy.
Yeah, and a lot of the players showed a lot of leadership as well in deciding to stay and to play. I was really struck with what Mike Nash said about the theme of overcoming adversity and coming together, because that was the case for the football players, for the school, and for the entire town of State College, Pennsylvania, which of course is so dependent economically on the school and the football program, those 6 or 7 home football games, bringing back the crowds. I think there's a lot to be said for how that group holds together and what it shows to their future employers. That idea that they did something they didn't have to do and they wanted to do. It's a little bit of a contrast, I feel like, too, to the corporatization of college football now. And I might be getting really opening the nest here and getting into trouble by saying a lot of this. But this idea that everyone is profiting off of name, image, and likeness. Yes, I know that college players have done a lot and they do deserve a lot of the money that comes to them that normally goes to the school. But this was really about playing for more than money. And for that 2012 football team, it brought them together.
Well, it's, as Mike Nash said, it was the lesson in this documentary is how you face adversity. Do you stand 10 feet tall at the moment of truth, or do you just say, I'll let someone else do it?
Yeah.
And these kids here, when Mike Mauder said they had a meeting one night, 11 o'clock at night, and said 30 to 40 kids may be leaving the program immediately. Mm-hmm. And there are corporate jets lined up on that. They have a little airport in the top of the hill at Penn State. And they're from other colleges who were just like, you know, picking the low-hanging fruit, picking players off that wanted to leave and go play for a school because they didn't know what the future was going to hold. Were their scholarships going to be taken away? Would the football program close down? And these guys just, you know, all got together and, you know, just stood 10 feet tall. They galvanized. And because of then, Penn State right now is thriving. That will always be, those incidents will always be in the rearview mirror, but there'll be tiny specks at some point. And someday, 2011, 2012 is going to be a long, long time ago.
And you're right. We're talking about Penn State. I live in Pennsylvania. And it was mentioned, Penn State is out in nowhere in yeah. the state. In fact, you've got a sign that says off to Penn State, and you're like, what? Okay, I still need GPS to figure out where I'm going. So that little area needs Penn State,
yep.
and the businesses there, that's huge for them.
It's geographically located in the exact center of the state of yep. Pennsylvania, and it's very hard to get to. You either have to go to Pittsburgh and drive, or you go to some other place. You go to Harrisburg and you drive, but you eventually get there. I've been there a couple of times for games. I actually went down just for a Wednesday press conference one time when Joe Paterno was there. And you're right. You know, you stay downtown, and I blew through the town one time. We were driving at night. And I was staying in Altoona, Pennsylvania. And we drove through State College, and it's pitch black, so we just stopped and we get out of the car. It was like the Three Stooges. We looked at a sign and said, Altoona, that way. We overshot it by 23 miles.
It's easy to do.
Yeah.
Well, it's an exciting film, and it's a story that needed to be told, and I'm glad that they were able to do that.
My goal is to be the number one pick. That's something I've been dreaming of since a kid.
It feels better to be number one than number five.
I wear the number because of Mike.
We have a chance to go for 3 in a row.
Good numbers at a good time.
When I first started wearing that number, I was just happy and proud.
Bloomberg Business of Sports, the number of the week.
All right. You know what it's time for. Huddle around the week. It's a brand new season. The number of the week. We got a brand new set. Okay, well, we have a brand new chair. Okay, I just put on some clean socks. But we got a number of the week, folks, that you're going to love. And it's very timely. As we talk about the Ryder's Cup. The Ryder Cup.
Oh!
The first Ryder Cup was in 1927. Yep. It was won by the U.S. in Massachusetts at Worcester Country Club. The competition was four foursomes and eight singles matches. What was the final score?
The United States, that was the one where Ted Ray was at the end of his career for the United States won, I'll say 9-3.
Scarlett, your choice.
Wait.
12 points.
Ryder Cup is golf, and I'm betraying my lack of knowledge on golf here. I'll say the U.S. won. Lindsay, what did you say it was by?
Well, there were 12 points up for grabs. The United States, I said they win 9-3.
Okay. I'm going to go with they won 10-2 because Lynchy always comes in pretty well and does pretty well on this. So I just go one up.
See, you know what's messed up is that USA won 9.5, Britain 2.5.
So we both win. It's a tie.
It comes a win, yes. Both of you guys come up on stage.
Right. See, that's my strategy. Whatever Lynchy says, I'll just kind of tweak it a little bit.
Yeah, but if we invoke the Price is Right rule, Scarlett, you're out. You went over.
Man. I remember that week, man. Remember that week that you were so close, you missed it by like 2 cents, and you were over. And it was like, well, I was close. And it's like, no. Okay, all right. Right.
Fortunately, we're not playing by Price is Right rules, so we all win.
Hey, thank you all. You can catch this show on our Apple Podcast Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, or, you know, because we're very flexible, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Michael Barr, and you can follow me on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm Mike Lynch. You can follow me at Lynchy WCBB.
And I'm Scarlett Fu. I'm on Twitter at Scarlett Fu 1T. This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.